Okay, we're going to talk these four periods that I'm with you today and 2 weeks from today on the subject of spiritual warfare. Spiritual warfare has become sort of a current fad in evangelical circles, as evidenced by a very almost a spate of publications on the subject. Books on the subject in the last few years have mushroomed tremendously, coming from many different perspectives. And there is the possibility that you kind of become enamored of a trend or a fad. I see these developing in other groups, and it's always easier to look at other groups than it is to look at yourself and see what you're doing that might be of that nature. But I have no desire to be simply a part of a fad, as it were, that everybody's talking about these days. I can assure you that I never set out to become an expert in spiritual warfare, and I have something of a reticence to even consider myself an expert, and yet when you commit yourself to a book on the subject, as I have done, that kind of labels you, I guess, as that. My pilgrimage along this path has been a fairly long one. I went to Sierra Leone, West Africa as a missionary back in 1956, my wife and I and two children. And we were assigned to a tribal village to carry on basic pioneer missionary work, church planting, evangelism, everything that missionaries do in those situations we did. We had a medical clinic and a school and church and did village evangelism and all kinds of things, translation. And for those several years, we worked among this animistic tribal group. In 1959, returned to the States on furlough and were asked to teach missions at Fort Wayne Bible College. Long story that I won't go into detail on, but I've ended up being on furlough ever since, basically teaching missions. Well, as I began to teach on this subject, teach missions in general, I began to read literature that related to it, and in that process of that, I read some literature about this area of the demonic world and spiritual warfare, and it kind of, well, you say today, blew my mind. I simply was not used to thinking in those terms. Now, I had good, solid evangelical theology. I'd been to Taylor University and had a religion major there, and I went to the Biblical Seminary in New York and had inductive Bible study as my major there, and I was well prepared in that sense, but I discovered that I was almost totally unprepared either to understand the animistic belief system of the people I worked with or of the spirit world in general. Now, we as evangelicals have a tremendous, or we as people, I should say, I don't think it's simply evangelicals, but it applies to us as well, have a tremendous ability to hold our theology at two levels. One is a theoretical level, and one is a functional level. And we're going to talk about that discrepancy considerably as we go through this, because I think that the primary thrust of the warfare that most of us are engaged in has to do precisely with that problem, that we talk one thing but we live something else. We'll come back to that issue. But I discovered that my functional faith simply was not appropriate to the animistic society, certainly. And as I began to study that more, I became convinced that this was simply something missionaries needed to know. I mean, they're going out there talking to people for whom their whole life is this kind of a belief system, and we come without a functional belief in it. So I began to teach it. And it's dangerous to talk about it because on this subject, I can assure you that the day comes when you have to put up or shut up. Either Christ is victor over the enemy and you can approach that at a very functional level and it works, or it doesn't work. The challenge to me came in the form of our psychology teacher at the college, who was one of the finest Christian counselors I've ever known, had an excellent integration of her knowledge of both Christianity and psychology, very effective counselor. But she had a client that was not responding to the usual approach to these matters, and asked Eleanor and me if we would see this young lady and see if there was any demonic activity involved. Well, that's a little scary to do for the first time, but we did it, and we hadn't been talking with this young lady long until a voice came out of her saying, "I'm strong, you can't get me." And we believe to this day that that was indeed a demon speaking through the young lady. She had enough history of this. We learned subsequently that when she was just a small child, her grandmother had taken her to a spiritualist seance, maybe more than once. She had many things linking her with the occult in the past. And simply to say, we were directly involved with a demon for the first time. When we moved to Deerfield, a similar thing happened. The pastor, first of all, asked if I would speak on the subject a couple of Sunday evenings, which I did. A therapist in the church heard this and asked if we would see a couple of her clients. This is another person with impeccable evangelical credentials, Columbia Bible College, Moody Bible Institute, Trinity Divinity School, graduate degree in psychology, a PhD, a student in psychology, and a professional therapist. So we met with two of her clients. And one of them was a young lady who, when she got ready to go to the university, prayed, said, "God, if you give me enough money to get through the university and get a teacher's license, you could have my life." Well, you don't bargain with God for salvation. You take it on His terms, not your terms. God wasn't answering her prayer the way she wanted, so she probably displayed her true colors by going out into a cemetery and praying that prayer to Satan. And she literally said, "Satan, if you give me the money to go through the university and get a teacher's license, you can have my life." Well, she got through the university and got her teacher's license and was directing a school in a Christian church. And the voice was saying to her, "We delivered our end of the bargain. On your next birthday, you belong to us." And in fear, she went to the Christian counselor to get help. Counselor knew how to lead her to Christ, but that didn't seem to stop the voices and the claim that she'd made a vow to Satan. She had to pay her vow. And they needed help in claiming the power of the cross to break that vow, to break the promise that she'd made to Satan on the basis of what Christ did for us at the cross. We were able to do that, and that young lady is functioning still in our community in a normal fashion. She represents a whole class of people who are dabbling in the occult today in ways that are simply shocking. If you're not aware of what's going on in our society in terms of occult activity, the more I learn about it, the more appalled I am at how widespread it is. And I don't know, well, I've heard some reports about Wheaton, but I know that over in the North Shore where we live, there is a lot of teenage activity linked to Satanism. one of the leading high schools, they had a Satanist day when everybody that was into Satanism wore a black band on their arm. Well, that's one group of people that we are having to deal with in the church today. The second person she asked us to see was a person who had been in psychotherapy for 18 months, and they hadn't even come to a diagnosis of her condition. The psychiatrist was simply, and these were all evangelicals, the clinical psychologist, the therapist, the psychiatrist, the three people involved with her, and they were simply nonplussed at what they were experiencing in this woman, and had used all of the standard testing devices of psychiatry. And we today would recognize her as a satanic ritual abuse victim who was experiencing the results of that kind of the most severe of physical, sexual, mental, spiritual abuse that you can imagine. And in our first session together, we again encountered demonic activity, direct demonic activity, and we're dealing with that. And so from that time on, we've been in some fashion involved in dealing with people involved with demonic activity. Now, we're going to back up and take a look at this from a very basic point of view. We won't get into much of the dramatic end of it, probably in our time together. Maybe next time I'm here we will to some extent, but I want to try and lay the foundations first. Let me say that I work on a philosophy of life for myself that I developed many years ago, which says that the Christian life is the exciting process of trying to keep your balance. It's based on the premise that evil is always the perversion of a good. God made the world good. Truth and good are therefore within the circle of God's creation. Satan is a perverter. He can't create anything. He is an angel who has only delegated power. He can only do what God allows him to do. And that does not include creation. Therefore, he can only take what God has created and try to create something distinctive of his by perverting what God has done. We tend to assume that good and evil are opposites. So if you have good out at one end of an extreme, you would have evil at the other end. The problem is that that's not true. That good is here, and evil is here, and here. It's on both sides. And Satan sends his heirs in polar pairs, and he gets us to swing from here to here. To avoid this evil, you go to this evil over here. Now, if we had time, I think we could explore that on any topic you'd like to raise, and at least I've found that it seems to work on almost any subject you want. Just take one like relativism, for example. If you go to an absolute relativism out here where nothing is secure, there are no fixed positions, that obviously is totally anti-Christian. But so often the antidote to that is to go over to a place where you've got all fixed positions, and you go to an absolutism, and everything, Christianity actually becomes deterministic, and that's not true either. This is where Islam is. Islam is out here where everything is so totally controlled by God that man is without responsibility. Out in Africa, well, they brought a man into the hospital with his leg full of gangrene because they tried to treat it with native medicines, and it didn't work. And the doctor said, "Why didn't you bring him sooner? We could have saved that leg." And they said, "What God will." No. God does it. Everything's absolute. Everything is determined. That's not true either. The truth is that God has given us elements of truth, the basic principles we need to live life, and we need to apply them to life. and that implies changes that come with time and place. My lifestyle in the village in Sierra Leone is quite different than my lifestyle on the North Shore because I'm in a different culture. Not because I am Christian or not Christian, but because of the culture that I'm relating to. Now, that opens all kinds of avenues of possible exploration, but it simply says that the truth is here and the perversions are out here. Well, on the subject we're talking about, the extremes are out here to disbelieve in Satan and demons completely. There are no such things. Therefore, let's get on with living life scientifically. Or not going quite that far out, the idea, yes, I believe that they exist, but I've never encountered one. I don't think they're operating here in the United States, at least not on any significant scale. You may meet them in Africa or Amazonia, but you're not going to encounter them here in the United States. So again, we get on with living life on a cognitive basis rather than relating to a spirit world. Or out here where the animist says that everything that happens happens because of spirit activity. Life is just a virtual ritual of relationship to the spirit world. In the Christian tradition, those who want to blame all human problems on demons. So if you have a cold, you cast out the demon of the cold and you get rid of the cold. Or if you're angry, you have to cast out the demon of anger and you get rid of your anger. It's obviously not that simplistic either. I think demons get involved in all kinds of things. That's the worldview that we have to work with, but it's not so simple as simply casting out demons. People who try that just go in circles, round and round and round, generally, and they're forever casting out demons. Well, we'll come back to that issue. I'm simply saying that I'm committed to the proposition that our job is always to keep our balance based on what is true and not allow Satan to take us to any of these extremes out here or to any of his counterfeits. Because related to this idea of the going to extremes is the idea of counterfeiting truth and putting it right here alongside so it looks so much like the real thing that you adopt it instead of God's truth. For example, a Christian ought to be humble and a Christian ought to be confident. Now, when I say those two words together, a lot of people have difficulty because humility and confidence don't seem to go parallel in the thinking of many people, and that's because they bought Satan's counterfeit of them instead of what is really true about them. What is humility? Well, humility is not thinking bad about yourself. Humility is not saying, I'm no good. Humility, as Neil Anderson defines it, is confidence properly placed. True humility comes from my focus on God, not my focus on myself. And if I'm looking at myself and saying how bad I am, how weak I am, I can't do this, can't do that, can't do the other thing, that's not humility. That's what we call feelings of inferiority or insecurity. I grew up with a fairly full-blown inferiority complex in the sense that I saw everybody as being socially better than I was. Our home was at the lower end of the economic scale. In many ways is a very good home, but when you analyze it, student asked in class the other day if I came from a dysfunctional home. That's one of the current terms. And I said, well, I think every home is dysfunctional to a certain extent. You can find elements of dysfunctionality in most homes, even though they may be very, very good ones. Well, we had the good and the bad, but the point was that because we were poor, and I didn't have a ball glove, and I didn't have a bicycle, and I couldn't go even play ball with the guys, and I would love to have done that, and And I had a friend who lived in a mansion out in the country, and Saturday he sent the chauffeur in to pick me up and go out and play with him, and he had everything that I didn't have. And I just saw myself as being this poor little kid with all these socially superior people. And I struggled with that all my life. Went to college, and they thought I was stuck up because I didn't speak to them, and I didn't speak to them because I saw them as being socially above me, and I waited for the social superior to speak to the social inferior, and they saw me as a gifted leader-type person that ought to be taking leadership and even in saying hello to other people, and I didn't do that, so they thought I was stuck up. And you know how we misread each other that way very easily. And that's because we buy Satan's counterfeit. And I've gotten a lot of credit at times for being humble when all I was feeling inferior. And we really don't get any credit with God for looking at ourselves and feeling bad about ourselves. Humility really is self-forgetfulness in the contemplation of the greatness of God. And it's that also then gives us confidence, because we go out and say, I can do all things through Christ who strengthens me, because that's the source of our confidence. Again, not looking at myself and saying, oh boy, I'm pretty good, you know, I can do this and I can do that, and I've got this gift and that gift, and I, that's not confidence. That's self-confidence, but it's not the kind of confidence that the Scriptures speak about. Well, so we're in this process of trying to keep our balance against the enemy who is seeking to dissuade us. Now, I'm going to state up front a few propositions that we'll be working with as we go through this. One is that most of the Christian counseling that we do or are called on to do in the church is the result of poor discipling. That Christian counseling, for the most part, is doing the discipling we should have done a long time ago. The reason we haven't done a good job in discipling is that we've approached it primarily cognitively again. We give people all the right information. A student in my class at Trinity wrote in a paper he wrote for me this last quarter, I've been a Christian for 20 years, and I've never been discipled. I have lots of information that I've collected about God and the Bible, but I've never gotten it from my head to my heart. And so I'm living a carnal, fleshly Christian life. I'm walking in the flesh, not in the spirit. This is tremendous candor from a seminary student, but as a result of what he was learning about these issues that we're going to be discussing, he said, I just have to swallow my pride and admit that I'm a babe in Christ and I'm learning the ABCs. And he went on to become very specific about the things that were in his life that he was going to have to deal with. The problem is that we have not learned to apply truth at a functional level. Apostle Paul, writing to Timothy, said, those who oppose him, he, the servant of God, must gently instruct in the hope that God will grant them repentance, leading them to a knowledge of the truth. We're going to be working on the premise that the truth is what sets us free, and that they will come to their senses and escape from the trap of the devil who has taken them captive to do his will. Now, what's the trap of the devil? It's the lies that he tells us. It's the deception that he practices. It's those extremes, it's those perversions of truth that he introduces into our lives. C.S. Lewis in his Screwtape Letters, again, has just tremendous insight into this whole concept of deception and the way Satan uses that to gain control over people. So I would submit as a working premise for us that the degree to which any person believes and lives by a lie of the devil is the degree to which Satan has control over them. And there will be various degrees in various of our lives depending upon the degree to which we've fallen into a trap of the devil. Now, I have to to say that I've come to some of these understandings quite recently in my own life. I've had the pieces all there, but I never could quite put them together. But they suddenly, a few years ago, just seemed to fall together. And as I go now various places in the world, I discover that there are many people who are still in the trap of the devil. I sat with a missionary down in South America just a matter of a few weeks ago in November. And here was a dear woman who has devoted her whole life to translating the Bible for a Bibleless tribe, who hadn't really passed ABC in terms of the things we're talking about. And she was in the trap of the devil in an awful way. It just makes me angry when I see what Satan has been able to do to some of God's servants. I was in Europe back in September, speaking with a group of missionaries there. The man who was in charge of that meeting, the leader for the whole European area for this major mission, said to me after we'd been together for a while, "Can we go for a walk?" And he began to tell me about himself and about his family and about problems that he was facing. And it goes right back to this basic fundamental truth that we're talking about, that we are faced with an enemy whose primary tactic is deception. And that's what we're going to be focusing on today. This is why Paul says, I believe, in 2 Corinthians 10, 3-5, "For though we live in the world, we do not wage war as the world does. The weapons we fight with are not the weapons of the world. On the contrary, they have divine power to demolish strongholds." Now, I think Paul's talking about real spiritual power. And this is where we often have difficulty. We want to ascribe the power to cognitive truth, and that's only partially true. We'll talk about that. He says, "We demolish arguments and every pretension that sets itself up against the knowledge of God, and we take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ." This is a reflection, I think, of Jesus' statement, "If you continue in my word, then are you my disciples indeed, and you will know the truth, and the truth will make you free." Our 60s generation assumed that freedom was something you had, that freedom was good and that authority was bad. And as authority went up, freedom went down, and as freedom went up, authority went down. Now that's one of the devil's lies. That's one of his perversions. Truth is that freedom and truth go up and down together. Truth makes you free. And as you follow truth, you become free. That's true in any area of life. That's true certainly in the physical realm. Antinomianism just doesn't work in science. This idea that I don't believe in authority. You know, get up on the roof and say, "I don't believe in all these laws. I'm law of gravity business, you know, I'm going to fly." And you jump off the roof. Well, you won't break the law of gravity. You may break something else, but you won't break the law. In order to fly, you have to know the laws of aerodynamics, and you have to cooperate with those laws. We are free to fly when we follow the truth. So truth makes us free. Our ability to live in the world is dependent upon our knowledge of the world. The Africans thought I was very brilliant with all of my knowledge. But when they got me out into the jungle, then you know who was brilliant and who was dumb. You know, I was not free in the jungle. I was a prisoner of the bush in Africa, whereas they could read it like a book. They could tell you what animals had been there and how long ago they were there, and they could tell you what was poisonous and what wasn't poisonous and all the goods and bad things about it. I was the prisoner. Truth is what makes us free. Now, the same principle applies in the spiritual realm, that the degree to which We live by that which is not true, is the degree to which we are in a trap of the devil. It's where we need to apply the weapons of our warfare to bring down those strongholds and to apply truth to our lives, to take every thought captive to obey Christ. We'll talk about this in some functional relationships later on, but that's just one of the fundamental truths that we're talking about. Now, that's kind of a lot of introduction, but I think that it kind of lays the basis for what we're going to talk about. Let me just take it one step further in terms of a premise that we'll come back to again, and that is that people may not live what they profess, but they will always live what they believe. Okay? You agree with that statement? People may not live what they profess, but they will always live what they believe. That was a favorite saying of one of my college professors. And it's basically the difference between the theoretical theology that we hold and where we live every day. I know a lady in my past who was a Bible teacher. She was a very dominant kind of leader within the group, and had very strong ideas about Christian truth, enunciated them very clearly, and particularly in relation to death. We sorrow not as others who have no hope. Except when her husband died, she just fell apart. She couldn't practice what she preached, as we say, because it was not really a functional faith. It was simply something that she affirmed up here. Well, turn that around, and you can say that if you want a person to change their behavior, you can only do it by getting them to change their belief. Neil Anderson says in one of his books, a person cannot consistently behave in a manner that is inconsistent with what they believe about themselves. So if you want a person to change their behavior, you've got to change something in their belief system to make a permanent change of behavior. This is why we have so much trouble with our counseling and our discipline, that we simply tell people to change their behavior, but we don't give them the basis on which to change it. And what I'm saying is that we've got to go back to a fundamental belief system that begins with who God is and who we are in relation to God if we're going to get significant change. Now, we all begin this process with a problem that I call the worldview problem. James Sire, in his book The Universe Next Door, says that worldview is a set of presuppositions or assumptions which we hold consciously or subconsciously, and most often subconsciously, about the basic makeup of our world. Worldview is a set of mental categories that we develop into which we plug the data of our everyday experience to give it meaning. We can't tolerate things happening without some kind of coherence to them, so we build this thing that is technically called worldview that explains it. And we'll look at some of those explanation systems. And that is something that you absorb without realizing it from the culture in which you grow up. It's not something you learn in college. Now, you may go to philosophy class and study agnosticism and skepticism and deism and all of these belief systems, and they're all kinds of worldviews, but most of them are held at an intellectual level, not at a functional level, and you find, again, that discrepancy. So we're talking now about what you really believe. We're talking about that which really guides your life, what you can really plug in with meaning. So when your loved one dies, your faith really functions in that context, and the power that you say exists there, the grace of God, becomes a really functional thing. To some extent, it's like one of the writers on the subject says, it's a series of lenses through which you look at at reality. Everything that happens in life, he would call reality with a capital R. And you look at this through the lens of culture, which tells you what you believe to be possible. The Africans, I would tell them that airplane up there might have 100 people in it, and they didn't believe that was possible. They had nothing in their experience or their explanation systems which allowed a boat to fly through the sky with 100 people in it. So our belief system will tell us whether demonic activity is possible or not possible, or to what degree it's possible in certain situations. We have set categories that function like lenses. And when I take off my glasses, you suddenly become a blur. I could hardly distinguish one person from another. My eyes are that bad, but when I put them on, it all comes into focus. One of my sisters works with things called Erlen lenses, which is based on a discovery that visually oriented learning disabilities like dyslexia and things of that nature can be corrected by simply putting a tint, the right tint, in glasses. And she's had the experience of having people put their glasses on for the first time and say, is that what it's supposed to look like? Seeing her depth perception wrong, so they've never seen a landscape. One girl put them on and looked up at the map in the front of the classroom and said, no wonder I could never understand what the teacher was saying. She couldn't see the map correctly until she got the right tint in her glasses. Well, that's something like what worldview is. It's looking at the experiences of life with the right set of lenses, so you're seeing what's really there rather than what is there because of the lens that may be perverted by our culture or by what we have experienced. So many people say, well, I believe in demons because they're in the Bible, but I've never seen one or met one, so, you know, let's get on with life on the basis I understand. Or what we analyze, we may have experienced something but not stopped to analyze it properly from a Christian point of view. I have a pastor friend who had an experience with a demonized person, the supernatural strength and all, and he just got scared off and backed off from it and said, I'm not going to mess with this. Well, his failure to analyze that from a Christian point of view as to how to apply the victory of Christ, we end up with a view of reality or a view of life that is really quite different from what it actually is. And so we need to get our worldview straightened out if we're going to really understand what we're talking about. We can spend a lot of time on worldview, and I'm way behind where I'd hoped to be by the end of this period. We're just about there at the end of the period. Let me just quickly introduce you to two belief systems. One is called animism, which is the belief system held more widely in the world than any other belief system. Every major religion practices animism in spite of what they teach. So if you're a Muslim, a Buddhist, a Hindu, even Christians, at the bottom crust level of life, there is a crust of animistic practice. So you go to Western Europe and in France, you find more magical healers than medical doctors. They're operating on an animistic basis that there is an impersonal spiritual power abroad in the world that can be manipulated by people, and particularly by specialists, technically called a shaman, though we have many folk religion terms for these people, who manipulate this spiritual power. The impersonal power, like electricity, which is neither good nor bad in itself. It can light lights and turn motors, or it can kill you. It depends on how you use it. And so you have to learn to manipulate that power. And that kind of a belief system pervades the world today. It's what's behind the New Age movement. The idea of the crystals and the idea that I am God. I can control my own destiny because I can control this impersonal spiritual power. It's all part of a fundamental worldview that is simply wrong. They also believe in personal spirits, that there are beings that are spirit beings that you have to relate to, and that those spirit beings are constantly involved in life down here. And even if you go and prove to them that that disease was caused by a germ, not by a demon, they want to know who sent the germ. There's always a spirit power behind whatever happens. Even if it's something that can be explained scientifically, there's still going to be a spiritual explanation system for it. And this kind of belief system, I say, tends to pervade the living level of most people, what we call folk religion level. That's where it's practiced. The problem is that we come from a world that we say looks like this, that has a supernatural realm and a natural realm. This is where God and spirits are, up in the supernatural realm. This is the realm of science. It's run by natural law. And our explanation system for the phenomena of our lives is scientific. We can explain why things happen by reference to what we call scientific law. Now, we've become functional deists. We've long since rejected deism as a valid worldview. Deism says that there is a God who created the world. He established these natural laws by which it runs, started it running. He went back to heaven and sits on his throne and lets it run that way. Now, that's far more the belief system of many evangelical theologians than they want to admit. And I've talked to some of them. One man who would be one of the leading evangelical theologians in the country said to me, "I am disturbed by how deistic my thinking is." Now, the problem is that that's our worldview that pervades our society that we've grown up in, and we've bought it whether we realize it or not. So we ask either-or kinds of religions questions, is it religious or is it scientific? And we think that we can separate those two, and it's because we have a false definition of science. Science is simply man's correct observation of the way God has made the world, but that doesn't take it out of God's hands and make it a neutral something instead of a spiritual something. Well, our time is gone, and we need to close, so you can go have some coffee and just through the morning. We'll come back and talk about the rest of the worldview problem in the next hour.